Blog Talk Radio.
Well, hello, and welcome to Indie Streak. My name is Rachel Galvin, and as you know, I interview film industry professionals on this show. If you've missed any of the shows, you can go back and listen to the archives. Well, today I'm interviewing Herbert Midgley, the director of The Rise of the Robots, and I do believe I have him on the line here. Herb, are you there?
Ooh.
Oh, there you are.
Hello.
How are you?
How y'all doing?
Good.
Awesome.
Okay, we're going to dive right in. Why don't you tell everybody a little bit about your film, what it's about, for those that haven't seen it yet.
Yes, The Rise of the Robots is a film that's nostalgic of these B-1950s, 1960s sci-fi films that basically has an ensemble cast. Basically, robots are taking over the Earth, and four people have to fight against the robots to save humanity. And basically, kind of the nostalgic, you know, back in the days when folks used to watch movies two or three times a week, some of the movies would be the A films, the high Hollywood production films, and then there'd be some films that would be the more the B films, the films that aren't didn't have the major actors in it, didn't have the biggest budgets, and it was just a film to go out and enjoy. And a lot of times with this type of films, the poster would be the one that would be what would draw you into the film, because this is long before the internet, long before trailers you could watch online or on TV. And it was just a fun, nostalgic ride for science fiction fans.
Mm-hmm. And did you make the poster yourself?
What I did was one thing that I would stress out to independent filmmakers, to make sure you take a lot of production photos and also get some stage photos as well. And basically had an artist, had a couple artists actually draw and paint different things. I told them what I was wanting. And if you are familiar with the Forbidden Planet's poster,
mm-hmm.
Which is very iconic. It has basically Robbie the Robot holding the girl in the background. And then from there, a lot of other science fiction posters with the same thing. If you think there's a robot monster, did the same thing as well. So I wanted that because I had a robot. I wanted the robot to hold the girl protagonist in his arms. And then I wanted, of course, the ensemble cast there. I wanted the truck there. I wanted the Mayan calendar. I wanted the human robots, what I call them, in the background as well. And then once we I think there was like eight altogether. I picked the one that I thought captured the film the most. And then
mm-hmm.
I had Ricky Kennedy, who's an excellent talent on multiple levels, filmmaker, as well as also amazing at the poster design for graphic arts. He went and put the text on there and just gelled together and looked amazing. I was so happy to actually have a poster that's actually a painted poster, because back at one point, you know, if you look at Star Wars, look at Indiana Jones, look at the posters before, they were painted they weren't photoshopped together. And there's
mm-hmm.
something special about having an actual painting as your poster, and I fought really and worked really hard to make that happen.
And what inspired you to do this specific film?
One thing is I've written, this is the seventh screenplay that I wrote, and I'm writing some now as well. And basically one of my friends had said something, why make a film that everybody else has done before? Why do the same thing that someone has done before? And so I knew I wanted to make a film that I could shoot. And that's one of the things you got to be realistic about. If you're shooting your own independent film, if you're doing a Hollywood film, well, they got money, they can throw at it and do a bunch of stuff, you know. But in reality, you know, you're the town that you're at, the amount of actors that you have, amount of sets and locations you have. And I really was sitting down thinking, who would be a person that would be least likely to save the world? And we have a professor, we have a local hillbilly, we have the girl, which pretty much every science fiction film from the 50s on up has an attractive girl
mm-hmm.
as part of the ensemble. If you look at Sliders, you look at Star Wars, you can just go on and on. And I thought, well, What about somebody that's a slacker, someone that doesn't really do much, someone that doesn't have a job, someone that just kind of slides through life, and that would be the person that would save the world? Very, very fascinating. And so, and also one of the big things, even though I love technology, is that I really see in the last 20 years, 15 years, how dependent people have gotten on technology, even so much so that they don't even want to drive someplace that there's don't have cell phone coverage. And I thought, well, in a lot of ways, we are kind of losing our ability to actually talk with social networking, actually talk face-to-face to people, actually have friendships, actually go out and do things with friends. And I truly feel, as an independent filmmaker, that you want to be able to make a film that has a message, because that's one thing that we can do that Hollywood can't do. Hollywood really, they can do explosions, they can get their big actors, they can have the big paychecks and things like that. However, the independent films that I see, usually there's a message, and usually a strong message that you just don't see anymore in mainstream films. And so the message is there, not too preachy, but it is definitely there if you watch the film and know that, hey, this is what it's about. And after folks have seen the film, tell me, I know exactly what you're talking about. I see this all the time. There's a couple of memes online where kids are walking around with cell phones, and it says the zombies have already happened. The zombie apocalypse has already happened. And so that's the concept of that, putting that together. And probably the biggest thing as well, as you're sort of restricted a little bit as independent filmmakers, is that what can you shoot? I've got a couple of locations. I know I can get four main actors to commit to a three-week principal photography, and then as many extras as I can get, and put it together and with a lot of hard work with the crew, cast, and then and a long time in post to pull off something that is to me is a really fun ride to watch.
Yeah, I noticed that you filmed on a college campus primarily, it looked like. Was that difficult to get?
No, the one thing about shooting in Nacogdoches, and I'm sure a lot of towns that outside of L.A., outside of the place where people shoot all the time, people are really friendly here. We went, and there's a lot of different stages of making a film. One is, of course, writing the script, and then pre-production is probably the part that is going to make or break your film, and pre-production is vital. And so we went around and got permission, talked to people. Pretty much, I think everybody said yes that we went to ask for locations. And basically just make sure to let them know, hey, what we're doing, what days we're doing this, be professional about it. If rain happened, you know, this get same contact with them, say we couldn't come today because of the rain or whatever. That pre-production is so vital to be able to do it. But also the area here in East Texas is very very, very good for making films, and they really want to work with you, and they're so nice. There was a film that was shot here that a Hollywood director came out and shot in this area, and he was shocked how they would actually offer a place, and he might even make you food as well. And thank you for coming out. And as you know, being on the film set, you know, you have lights everywhere, you have cables everywhere, you know, people walking all over, and it's a big intrusion on your life. And they're just very happy and thankful to let you do this. And it's amazing.
And you must have had a heck of a craft service with all those extras.
Yeah, that's one thing that you plan as well. And you figure out that, you know, you get your main crew that's going to be there. And, of course, the main cast in this particular film was basically the four individuals were pretty much almost in every scene. And then the hardest part is getting the extras. You know, basically, that's a lot of work. Go out there, put up signs, email people, talk to people, communicate with people. And even then, I would love to have 10 times more extras. It's difficult, you know. And I've been extras on some big films. And they pay you a pretty decent salary to come out. You know, we don't have that option. We just basically come out, please, we got some crafty for you. Come out and do this. And fortunately, we had a lot of love here in Nacogdoches for the robot film, and we had enough extras to be able to sell that the world is being taken over by robots.
Now, did you make the robot? And it looked like there was more than one. Was there actually just one? It was a special effect?
Initially, I was wanting to shoot this film kind of like a 50s or 60s film with everything in camera, with matte paintings, a real practical full-size UFO, and I knew I needed a robot. One of my friends, Jim Egner, he has a skill of making props, and he can design pretty much anything that you set your mind out to. And I knew he could make a robot where I could afford a robot. Doing research, Robbie, a robot, I think at the time was like $500,000 robot, like $1950s dollars, So it was like a very expensive prop. Obviously, we don't have that as an independent filmmaker. And I kind of gave him the guise of doing the cross between Robbie the Robot and B9 from Lost in Space, because those are two iconic robots that are just really alike from the past. And he came up with a couple of designs, and I picked a design that I thought would ensemble that. And of course, it also had to be a robot that someone could go walk in, get in, and be functional. The reality, though, is that I couldn't make 3,000 robots. I could make one robot, and with the magic of After Effects and green screen, you can make the illusion of having a lot of robots in a film. And if the title says The Rise of the Robots, you're going to need some robots in this film. And I think in a lot of ways, people just love the robot from The Rise of the Robots. It just looks great. I still got it. I got it upstairs, ready to take it out to places. And if we have a sequel coming up, I have it ready to go as well.
What about the UFO that lands? How is that made? Is that
the
visual effect? Or?
Yeah. Well, initially, again, I wanted to do everything that was practical. So we spent months building a full-size UFO. Nancy Andrew was a production designer, and she said we could make a full-size UFO. And we did. We went there and built it, plywood. And I remember it was Ricky Kennedy said this, that, at one point, the Millennium Falcon was this. Just a bunch of plywood and whatnot like that, and it becomes iconic on film. And went out there and built it. Basically, you're building like a house. You're building it and then you're painting it and putting everything on it, putting the lights and whatnot. And it was really I wanted that scene from ET, basically, where the aliens first land down, the ET aliens land down, and all the smoke just comes out of the UFO. And so having a practical UFO, we were able to do that, live in the camera. And then the reality set in that I need to be able to have this UFO have space flights and things like that. And so we came up, Nancy made some models of the UFO and After Effects. Trey Cartwright, the visual effects supervisor, was able to put it together and make some magic things happen in the CGI aspects of the robot film.
Now, the film is set in the present day, and yet it looks old. Why did you decide to do that, and how did you do that?
One of the things is stylistically, visually. I was very fortunate to have some incredible people around. Nancy Andrews, as I talked about, Ricky Kennedy as assistant director. Ryan Blackburn as director of photography, and Trey Cartwright as the visual effects supervisor. We're talking with Ryan, of course, with the DP. He's going to give you the look of the film. And he went back and watched a lot of these old films. And if you look at the films from the past, they didn't have the shaky cam. Things were locked down on sticks, as we call them, tripod, for those out there that aren't used to the terms. So things are locked down shots. And, you pan the camera this way and the other. And looking at the film, the footage looks great. We're shooting in high def. The footage looks amazing, especially the outside footage. And he did an amazing job as a director of photography. Really, it really helps tell us the story through his vision of it. And looking at the cuts of it, I folks didn't just quite get it. So talking to the visual effects supervisor, Trey, he said, well, let's go through, and for lack of a better term, we call this grindhouse. And even when we're shooting the film, we're thinking, well, maybe we should grindhouse. it all goes back. There was a version of Star Wars that came on online that I think it's somewhere on the internet that you watch streaming. It's called Attack of the Stars, and basically they take Star Wars and find the 16mm copies of it and grindhouse it, for lack of a better term. They basically age the film, add a little bit more gruesome effects and things like that. And it was like watching Star Wars like new for the first time. And I kind of said, joked around at the time when we were shooting it, well, maybe we should grindhouse the robot film and see how it looks. Well, after we had the first couple cuts of the robot film, it wasn't quite working. And people didn't quite know. As soon as we threw the layers of grain and dirt and scratches and trying to mimic a film that was put together from all these other copies of films, kind of like a, if you think of some of the lost films that were put together and compiled from several different films to make one film, that was basically kind of the concept of this here, that it would be like Metropolis, that this film was lost, and, you know, 30 years later, we found it, we're showing it for again. So when you see the film, when folks out there see the film, you can see that there's different grains. Some of the footage looks okay. Some of it looks really, really, really distorted in a lot of ways as well. And it just kind of gives you that nostalgia. What I was hoping was that this film is seen in the movie theater, and you really get the idea of that you get popcorn going on, and you're going to one of these midnight movies, these movies at a dollar theater, and you're seeing a print that's not that, and you're just enjoying it because, you know, it's kind of part of the experience that you're watching a film that could break at any time or has so much of scratches and grains. And, you know, but back, we've kind of lost that now because everything's digital when you go watch a film in a movie theater now. At one point, you know, films would age. They would break. They would get scratches. Every time you run a film through a projector, it gets scratched up. And it's just the person knew what they were doing. And so that was basically the effect of this, that once we threw that onto the Rise of the Robots, it really helped sell this as well. And hopefully folks enjoy seeing that and kind of get the idea of that. The thing that I look at as an independent filmmaker, I try to do the opposite of what Hollywood does. Hollywood, you know, wants this super high def 3D, you know, explosions and effects that look perfect as they can get. And as an independent filmmaker, I just don't have the funds to do that. You know, you look at, you know, end of these big, you know, Godzilla or Transformers, you know, there's about 2,000-3,000 people that's worked on the special effects. You know, I had one. and so there's no way to compete with that. So instead of being sad about that, you just embrace what you're able to do, and you just go along with that. And I think in a lot of ways, Grindhouse in the film was a good stylistic visual effect, along with Ryan's DP, and that just really makes the robot film feel like one of these 50s, 60s B science fiction films.
Mm-hmm. You have some scenes in the very beginning and they actually repeat with some floating planets and the UFO in the sky. Was that stop motion or was that digital also?
What we did was Nancy Andrew, the production designer, she made some models, and we basically shot that in front of a green screen. And once we had it in a green screen, we were able to take it in After Effects and just layer it together and put it together. And I think about a third of the Rise of Robots is visual effects. It's something that's on there. Anytime you see the robots, that was something that was done in After Effects. The set of the robots on the ship, you know, is a miniature. The planet Robotus is a you know, little miniature thing. The UFOs, all those things are just miniature models put together with After Effects. And hopefully it's a fun ride that, again, a lot of these films in the 50s and 60s didn't have a lot of money for special effects. If you ever seen Robot Monster, you all know what I'm talking about. So if you understand what Robot Monster is or Planet Nine from Outer Space, you kind of get the idea of what kind of film this film was trying to be a nostalgic for.
Mm-hmm. You also talk a lot about Mayan prophecy, and you had that big stone wheel. Where did you get that? Did you make that?
Nancy Andrew made that from scratch. It's a
four-foot
radius one that if you didn't know if you were looking at something that was a prop from a movie, you thought it came right from the Mayan village somewhere. That was the first prop that was worked on, and that goes back to pre-production, finding folks that have a skill set that you're able to make to use in your film. And a lot of it is just having that ability to plan things out. Initially, I was hoping to have this film done by the Mayan, by December the 21st, 2012. And, sadly, with, how long post-prediction takes, it didn't quite happen that way. But I think people know that Mayan prophecy and folks can, if you go look at Escape from New York, it's set in, 1997, even though today's 2014, you just go along with it. You don't worry about it. It says today's now. You just go along with that.
Mm-hmm. You have this toy that saves the world at the end. I don't want to give it away, but I was so excited to see it because I have one of those. Believe it or not, I have one.
One of those things is that, when you make a film, when I look at The Rise of Robots, how much influence from other films are in this film? I mean, there's influence from Star Trek IV. There's influence from The Simpsons. There's influence from tons of, Star Trek, tons of films. There's influences and little, I'm not going to call them side jokes, but little nods to some of these films as well.
Mm-hmm.
And certain things to me, certain props are just iconic. And as you know, let's say Sliders. If you remember the little sliding device,
mm-hmm.
It was basically a phone that you could have bought around that time period, and they put some lights on it and this, that, and other. Star Trek, the original, the TOS, the original series, they would, they had no money, they had no budget, so they would take things and, just make it, make it look more futuristic. And I thought, I actually had a couple of hand props made from scratch, and I thought, I talked to Jim Egner, he made the hand props. Could you put this one device in there and make it work, because I really want this device. And again, I'll be like you, that not give it away. And so this iconic from the 70s, 80s. And I think the younger generation doesn't know what those are, so I think this looks kind of cool to me. But I know what it is, and pretty much other folks would know what it is, too, that had those back in the day.
Yeah. Are you still there?
Oh, yeah, I'm still here.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was going to ask you, too, there's a scene toward the end when they get this truth where there's kind of a kaleidoscope scene. Was that also done in visual effects? That was pretty impressive.
That's all Trey Cartwright. We went through, and I wanted something that was as iconic as I could do special effects-wise. And there's a little homages to Star Trek IV, maybe a little bit to Doctor Who,
mm-hmm.
some of those aspects of traveling through time or some big event going on. And, I think in some ways, because you've seen a lot of really, kind of cheesy special effects, when you get to that one, it's like, wow, this is really kind of cool to watch it, this little aspect here. And I was trying
mm-hmm.
to mimic whatever the truth it would be in the mind of those characters, and if you remember in Star Trek IV when they travel back in time, and basically you have all these images going on. Sometimes the more vague of images you have, it's actually more effective than actually showing. Okay, well this is actually what happens when you travel back in time. When you're trying
mm-hmm.
to find the truth of humanity. That was the same kind of concept, but yeah, Trey did an amazing job, and I think in some of that the sound effects and the music adds to that as well. And there's so many different layers to making a film that it's just amazing. And having the best people around you work is makes your life so much easier.
You mentioned the music. Did you do all the music? I could definitely tell you did the last song, the Rise of the Robot song. Did you do everything?
Yeah, my first degrees were in music composition. And the thing that I always wanted to write music for films. It wasn't really until I went to film school and when I started meeting filmmakers that I actually get asked to write a lot of music. And one of my gifts is that I can just write music very fast. I think partially because I make films, I understand the process of it. And a lot of times you just don't have, sadly in post, a lot of times you just don't have time. You got to get the film out. And I can work really fast. I wanted an iconic theme. And usually every showing of the robot film that I've been to, someone comes out humming the melody of the robot theme. And there's something very, something that's very catchy, very iconic that goes along with this. And because I had a little time this summer, actually I scored it out for a string orchestra, Sight Red, and it sounds amazing live, and hopefully I'll get a better recording of it at some point as well. And I might make a band version of it as well. So you might look out for the Rise of the Robots theme out there in junior high or high school at some point. But yeah, it's a good challenge to go out there to match, because as a composer, I usually hear something one way, and I go along with that. And with myself, I can work myself relatively easy. When I work with other folks, I kind of say, well, this is what I'm hearing. If they have like a different idea of that, I kind of got to work around what they're able to do as well, and with my best of my abilities with the time constraints as well. I don't have a full orchestra on command that I can just go out there and have do things, but it's a very fun challenge to make soundtracks. And I've had several short films and a feature film that has won awards, and hopefully the music has played at least a small part in them getting awards for some of those films.
Well, I know you were the composer of Time Travel, and we had Ricky Kennedy, the director, on our show here. And now, was he also the assistant director for you on your film?
Yes, Ricky was the AD, the assistant director, and amazing job. Made my life so easy. There's so many people on a film set that you got to have that are good people, and the assistant director is the one that you just work hand in hand. Him and I worked really well with Ryan, the DP, and Nancy, the production designer. We all just worked together so well on set, and it was amazing the amount of work that Ricky put into the film and just helped make this film be an iconic film. And talking to him, this is good for future filmmakers as well, is that when he was making his feature film, a lot of the experiences that he had on my film was shot a year before his film, was made his film go even more smooth. So whatever position you're at when you're getting ready to do your own film, you draw from all those experiences and probably make your film better because of those experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And I know all the film sets I've been on have helped me make a better film myself as well, and I continue to want to get on sets to learn more and more. Lloyd Kaufman was over there at the con,
Super Geek Film Festival.
At the film, Super Geek Film Festival, and he, he says it right. I mean, he just goes on. He wants to go work on people's films to even learn more stuff. Even though he's been making films for 40 years, he's still not done learning things. And that's the spirit that you have as a filmmaker. You just you got to be open and learn things and constantly be aware of what's going on in the industry today with technology. There's so much stuff to learn. Every day there's a new camera that comes out. Every day there's some new lights coming out. And it's just getting easier and easier for for filmmakers to make films now. Even more cost, make it where at one point, 30 years ago, I don't think I could ever afford to make the robot film just because unless I shot a video, I couldn't shoot a film. And today, with technology, I was able to make a film that looks really good. When I got to see it in a full-size movie theater, it looks great.
You mentioned the Super Geek Film Festival that it was shown at. Was it shown at other film festivals, or where will it be shown next?
I got to see it in Roswell, New Mexico, and in a movie theater. And I've screened it for folks that have worked at. Right now, I'm trying to think if we got any. Still, some film festivals haven't. I got entered in a few more film festivals. I haven't heard back from them. I think this month, end of this month, and the beginning of next month in August, I heard back from some more of them. I think the October is kind of the next big bunch of film festivals that come out. And so I haven't quite heard back from them yet. So hopefully they'll be out there. And hopefully at some point I'll do, I'm looking at some different aspects of doing some type of distribution. So that'll be probably like a year away. I think a lot of times that's another thing that independent filmmakers need to realize, that every part of the process just takes time, especially if you want to do it right. And looking at different options for distribution. And fortunately, there's a lot of options today. There are a lot of options that you can do for distribution. Even if you need to do self-distribution, it's definitely an option that 30 years ago, I don't think filmmakers really had that option, Holly, to do. You just couldn't afford it. Today, you can afford to do that. And one of the goals also of this is that, if you look at the end of the credits of The Rise of the Robots, so many people worked on this film. And as a filmmaker, I really feel it's my job, my responsibility, to get this film seen and get this film out there in the public, because all these people worked on this film, and no one else is going to go out there and promote your film. You've got to be able to go out there and do it and get people to see this work and also learn from it. Every time I show this film, I learn something from the audience. I kind of feel, okay, does this work? This doesn't work. And you keep that in mind for the next films you make. Mm-hmm. And obviously, if you make 10, 20 films, your 20th film is probably going to be a lot better than your first film. I mean, it just is. And the more time you spend on set, it's going to make your films better. And the more that you understand how to tell a story, how to engage an audience, is going to make your films better and better. And, when you see independent filmmakers like Lloyd Kaufman, I mean, goes out there and makes films, has something to say. And he does it in a unique way, definitely, and not a mainstream way, but he has that voice that he wants to go out there and make a film, and he goes out there and makes films. And that's the challenge to go out there that, when you walk around, when I walk around East Texas, or not many people have made a feature film. I mean, it's very rare to actually run into folks that have made a feature film. It's rare for the run into people that made short films. And so when you run into a feature film, it's even more rare. And you got to have that ability. How bad do you want to make this thing happen? And that was the thoughts on the robot film. All four of us that worked really hard for pre-production wanted to make the best film that we can make. And we all worked so hard to make that happen. And I feel very fortunate and lucky to got a chance to work with so many amazing people to make The Rise of the Robots happen.
I noticed in the credits that you thanked the Nacogdoches Blueberry Festival, but I didn't see any blueberries. What was that about?
Well, they let us. Nacogdoches has probably the biggest blueberry festival around. East Texas, we're very lucky to have a lot of rain and water, kind of like in Florida in a lot of ways, and so we can grow peaches and blueberries and a bunch of other crops as well. They let us extras, and so, because there's a lot of people walking around in that festival, I was able to get a lot of extras to walk around and do things. So you actually do see some scenes of that. You didn't see any blueberries, but you did see some scenes of the blueberry festival in the background of the extras walking around. Yeah. So, again, that was innovation. You need extras, go where extras are at. So they're going to be at a festival. Mm-hmm. You make this little scene here work in your film. Yes, you could. Okay, well, make it happen. And so, and the city of Nacogdoches, the university, so many people to thank. They just went out of the way to help us make a film, and it really makes my heart happy to know that so many people, the Chamber of Commerce, there's so many people that gave a lot of love to the robot film, and you know, I can't thank them in words. I mean, just amazing.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you want to give everybody the website for Rise of the Robots, and also, you know, you have over 3,000 YouTube videos. Maybe give them that site as well.
Sure. I have a Facebook page. If you do search for the Rise of the Robots, you can find the Facebook page. You can go to the Rise of the Robots, the Rise of the Robots film.com, and that will take you to the web page. And of course, if you want to send me an email, you can send me an email to theriseoftherobots@gmail.com, and I'd love to hear from you all out there. And if you'd like to see some of the quirky little videos that I've made throughout the last 7-8 years on YouTube, if you just do a search for Herbert Midgley on YouTube, if you do youtube.com/HerbertMidgley, all one word, you can see some of the art I do as a little short films as well.
Okay. Now, what's next for you? Are you already working on, you're writing a screenplay?
Yeah, well, I'm working on a screenplay right now that has to do with kind of a singer-songwriter type film. And then I always have back in my mind a couple other science fiction films that do as well. And I got another 5 screenplays ready to go right now that I have scripts for. That's one thing that, as an independent filmmaker, you just constantly got to have stuff ready to go. And so when you get a chance to, when you get something to green light, you got material that you can actually do. And so, yeah, you're constantly working on it. The robot film, I think I may write a play version of the robot film just because I think it would work as a play as well. I started off as a playwright many, many years ago, and I wouldn't mind going back into the roots of that, trying to write the robot film as a fun, cheesy one-act or maybe two-act play. And just kind of... Just had a lot of fun with that. And, yeah, so just, you know, you got to just keep on writing, keep on producing, keep on making short films. I have an idea for a short film that I'll probably do in the next 2 or 3 months as well, and as well as a couple of documentaries as well. So there's always something in the fire to do and whatnot.
Okay. Well, we're about ready to wrap up. Is there any last thing that you want to tell budding filmmakers out there? Any last advice?
I guess really the big thing is that if you want to call yourself a filmmaker, you got to make films. And it doesn't matter if it's a 30-second film, if it's a short film, if it's a feature film. Go out there and make it happen. Go out there, work with people. Go out there and be organized. Be serious about your craft. You can have fun, but when you talk about making films, you're serious about making films because that's what you're doing. And I think also it's really easy to get discouraged in this field. I would suggest is don't go at this field trying to make the $1 million, trying to make it as a superstar. There and make films with something that you want to say, and you produce a product. You've already made way more than what money could compensate you for, and it's the art, it's the craft of filmmaking. And that's what drew me into making films. After doing many years of music and writing and acting and whatnot, there's a German word called Gesamtkunstwerk, and it means the total artwork. And in my mind, filmmaking is that it's a connection, it's a completion of writing and acting and music and organization and all that to put together to make a film. So, and one last thing, don't get caught up on having to have the best camera. Go out there and make a film with whatever camera you have. And then, you know, when you get to the point where you can afford the big fit cameras, you can get them done.
All right. Well, thanks for being on the show today, Herb. And I'm sure I'll talk to you soon.
Definitely.
Everybody,
thank you so much.
Just see Rise of the Robots. All right.
Rise of the Robots, everybody.
Yeah, your next project, I'll bring you back for some more.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Rachel.
All right, thanks. Bye.
Bye.
Okay, well, that was a great conversation with Herb Mitchley, and he mentioned his YouTube site. You can check that out as well. You might just happen to see his movie in there, possibly. Also, guys, please go on to my Facebook site for this radio show. It's www.facebook.com/IndieStreak, just like the show. And please like the page. Once in a while, I'm unable to do a show, like last week. My family was in town. So if that happens, then you just, you know, I'll put something up on that site. So you can always check that out. Also, I'm working on the magazine for next issue, August issue right now. If you haven't seen Independent Streak magazine, please check it out. Go to www.independentstreakmagazine.com, and that's streak as in S-T-R-E-A-K. And if you'd like to be on this show, you can always email me, and I would be happy to take a look at your work. Or if you want to advertise in the magazine or on the show, I'm happy to talk to you about that as well. My email is ravenprods@yahoo.com. That's ravenprods@yahoo.com. Ravenprods, like productions, at yahoo.com. And I will be back next week with someone new, so please tune in next week. And in the meantime, you can go back and listen to all those archives that I have stacked up, and including Lloyd Kaufman, who we mentioned a couple times, that was at the Super Geek Film Festival. You can go back and listen to the interview I did with him. Okay, guys, thank you for tuning in, and I will talk to you next week.